Welcome to the Monday seminar series. We've got Orit Paleg, who will be speaking very, very soon. She'll be introduced by Alex. But first up, I'll just get through the announcements. So this week we are super excited to be launching our very first session of this Jour Fixe that we've got for PhD students. This is going to be happening every 2 weeks, and it's meant to be a sort of low threshold area for people to build networks and skills and basically vent and tell us what they want and what they need. It starts this week on Thursday. It's always at 11:45 every 2 weeks, like I said, and this first session is just an introduction to the format. So yeah, we're really excited. Next week, we have David Sumter as our speaker. So you can't get more relevant than the study of collective animal behavior as a talk for us. It will be a morning session, an 11:45 one. And the Zoom link and everything is on the website, and I'll send it in our usual newsletter format as well. That same week, we have an invitation actually from the Zukunftskolleg. They have a new series called Racism in Academia, and their opening lecture will be on the 2nd of December. And the speaker is Andrea Leilach-Henrich, who's from the politics department, and her talk will be What We Mean When We Talk About Race. So that's a open invitation for us. The event is on our website, and if you want the link, just send me an email. That is it. So I won't take your time any longer. This event is being recorded as usual, so don't stay if you don't want that. And I'll pass you on now to Alex.
So we are very happy today to be joined by Orit Paleg, whose work, as you're going to see, is incredibly relevant to everything we're doing. Orit did her degree in actually physics and computer science in Israel at Bar-Ilan University, and is one of the few scientists actually having, of course, I don't know this stuff, like everyone, I look it up, but you actually have a Wikipedia page, which is A, incredibly helpful, but B, I think must very much standardize your introductions, as everyone just reads verbatim what's written here. I'll give you the sort of short version. She then did a PhD at ETH Zurich, so very much in the neighborhood, in simple models of competitive interactions in biophysical systems. But as you're going to see today, Orit is one of these fantastic scientists that again transcends disciplinary boundaries and sort of uses techniques and modeling approaches from computer science and physics in living systems to offer new insights. Also from this Wikipedia, I think it's here or maybe somewhere else, it says you're a specialist in soft biological systems, which made me wonder what a hard biological system is, but maybe you can get to that in the talk. And as you're going to also see, Orit takes a very broad taxonomic coverage in her work. So of course, today we're going to hear about honeybees, but then cellular systems, and Orit and I also have a project together looking at plants, which is odd because I think neither of us inherently study plants. Somehow we got roped into that. Lastly, before I hand over to Orit, I'll just give one plug. Although the abstract deadline has passed, Orit and I are part of an editorial committee for a special edition of Frontiers in Physics called The Physics of Social Interactions. So if anything you see today inspires you to submit an abstract to that special edition, just throw it in and we'll consider it as a late entrant as well. Okay, so with that, thank you, Orit. We're all looking very much forward to this, and over to you.
Thank you so much, Alex. I only discovered they have a Wikipedia page like a week ago. I don't know who did this, but thank you, if you're here or anywhere. So thank you so much for inviting me to give this talk today. I'm really honored and humbled because Ian Cousins' work has always been a, a major inspiration for the things that I do today. So it's fantastic to have the opportunity to, as always, interact with Ian, but also with the rest of the group. And I'd love to have your feedback on some of these works that I'm going to present today. So I'm going to talk about honeybees and honeybee swarms. And I don't think I really need to introduce the concept of collective behavior to you, but I just wanted to briefly set the stage to the kind of collective behavior that I'm going to talk about today. So I'm pretty much, you know, in line with the work that you do in your group. I'm really interested in how animals and organisms sense their local environment, whether that, you know, some seminal examples of that is chemotaxis in cells and phototropism in plants, olfactory search in insects, and then how does all of this come together when you put a lot of organisms in one spot? A few examples that I'm sure, again, that you're all familiar with, slime mold, foraging, ant pheromone laying, and swarms of large groups of fish, birds, and insects. I want to make a slight distinction on the kind of work that I'm going to present today, which sometimes we refer to as a small extension of classical stigmatology, where in more classical stigmatology, I think this is just one example of that behavior. So we have organisms that deposit information in the environment. In this case, we have an Argentine ant finding a food source, and on the way back to the nest, she is touching her abdomen to the surface and marking it with a pheromone trail. And when you have a lot of these ants together, then of course they can create sophisticated, dynamic paths that are somewhat optimal to the food source, or to the from the food source to the nest, and vice versa. But these kind of information that is being deposited is first of all just being deposited, and then it's kind of diffused more passively. And also I want to talk about a few examples today where we have some indirect communication through fields, physical fields, that are less local than this example. And in particular, I'm going to talk about physical fields of flow and mechanics. And I'm gonna reiterate this concept for some of the examples that I'm going to show, and hopefully this will become more clear then. Okay, so for the outline today, I want to talk about two sets of problems. The first one is related to fields of mechanics, and that is related to honeybee swarms and the very dense aggregation that they create and the mechanical forces that manifest their decision-making. And the second set of problems I'm going to talk about is fields of airflow, in particular how honeybees ventilate their hive and use. So I'm going to talk about airflows and how they're being used to communicate also within large groups of honeybees. I want to point out that this is, I'm going to talk about some work that I did back in, when I was a postdoc at Harvard, together with Jacob Peters, Mary Salcedo, both were graduate students at the time, and our advisor, Mahadevan. And I'll also intersperse, you know, in between these two themes, some new projects that are going on in my lab right now. Okay, so let's start with the mechanics. So this is an example of a honeybee swarm. This is a phenomena that occurs as part of a reproductive cycle of European honeybees. At some point during the spring and summer months, the colony size increases and they split into two parts. And then one part and a queen fly away and they hang like this from a tree branch. And when they're doing so, they don't have a nest structure to protect themselves from the elements, and they have to adapt to environmental factors more dynamically. And indeed, they do. We know that from work of Tom Seeley and later on also Mahadevan, that honeybees, the swarms can actually adapt their density for the environmental temperature. So here on the right side, there is a swarm at cold temperatures. It's going to be more dense in comparison to a swarm that is present at higher ambient temperatures. They also respond to rain, and they, I hope you can see that. So in the picture here is the rain. They arrange themselves in almost pneumatic order, and presumably that makes the swarm less susceptible to water. And then at really high temperatures, it's been speculated that the bees create channels that allow for flow of air and exchange air from the colder environment and the warmer swarm. So all of this is, of course, very complicated and a complex set of skills that the bees have. But underneath all of this, there is a hard mechanical problem. I want to emphasize that in this picture here on the left side, there's nothing besides bees and a tree branch. So the bees are essentially holding hands, air brackets, to create that structure. And they need to adapt to several mechanical stimuli from the environment. They need to adapt to static mechanical forces that are coming from gravity. And they also need to adapt to more dynamic mechanical forces that are coming from potentially wind. So here is a swarm that we found on a windy day. This branch, I hope you can see the movie. This swarm is being shaken. And if it's going to be shaken too much, it's going to break. And if it breaks, that could be pretty catastrophic for the bees. They can fall to the ground, not find their way back to the swarm, and that basically kills the thermoregulation purpose of that structure, which is one of the main reasons it exists in the first place. So the bees basically huddle to also warm up. So we wanted to understand how the bees maintain mechanical stability in these large swarms. There are on average tens of thousands of individuals in each one of these swarms. So in this funny little illustration, I'm just want to point out that a bee at one side of the swarm can potentially coordinate its activity with other bees that are nearby, but it can certainly not directly communicate and coordinate its activity with a bee that is at the other side of the swarm. And mechanical stability sometimes really demands this simultaneous coordination throughout the structure. So we wanted to understand what kind of local mechanical signals the bees could be potentially using in order to stabilize the swarm. And to do that, we worked with real honeybees. I always like to point out that this was my first venture into experiments. Until that, I was comfortably sitting behind a computer simulating some other problems. So this was really fun. We worked at the Concord Field Station, which is not far away from Harvard. And this was our experimental setup. So we have the swarm attached to a wooden board, and we connected it to a motor that can basically shake the board at certain frequencies and accelerations. And then we just recorded the shape of the swarm from several different angles as a function of time. So that was the setup. It's actually a pretty simple do-it-yourself kind of setup. And then we also had a version where we shake the bees vertically as well. So it was started as an exploratory project, after the first couple of tries, we realized that when we shake the bees horizontally, after a while, the bees inside the swarm starts moving around inside the swarm, and they collectively change the aspect ratio of the swarm. So here is a fast forward version of that experiment. So we have the front view, the bottom view. We are shaking them right and left. And here is how it looked like. So we start with a cone-like structure that has a certain base area and height. And when we shake them, the bees spread out and they increase the surface area, the attachment base area, and decrease the height. And then when we stop shaking them, let me point it out. So that's right now. So now we're stopping shaking them. So they slowly starting to converge back to their steady state configuration. Okay, so we decided to continue studying this a bit more systematically. So a couple of things one can do with this kind of setup is to change the frequency or to change the acceleration that we apply on the board. And that's exactly what we did. So what you see here on this plot on the y-axis, that's the relative base area that we can see from the bottom view as a function of time. The different colors are the different frequencies that we applied on the swarm. And that dotted line is where we stopped the perturbation and continue recording to see how the swarm slowly go back to its steady state. Perhaps, you know, not too surprising, when the frequency is increasing, we see that the swarm spreads out more. So the higher the frequency, the more the spread out is. But because we're changing the frequency here, we can also plot the data a little bit differently, where instead of plotting it as a function of time, we can plot it as a function of perturbation events, where a perturbation event is one shake to the right and one shake to the left. And we can see that they all fall on this universal curve, besides, of course, reaching different plateau values. And I'll get to these different plateau values in a few slides, but I just wanted to show this because for us, this was an indication that there is actually a universal response to each one of these bumping events. Okay, so that was the effect of frequency. And next we turn to study the effect of acceleration, which is shown here. It's exactly the same plot. So the y-axis is showing the relative base area as a function of time. And just like before, the higher the frequency, the more the swarm spreads out. And then, you know, everything I just showed you is what happens when we shake the bees right and left, but we also had the ability to shake them up and down. And surprisingly, when we shake them up and down, the bees do not respond in the same way that they did to the horizontal perturbation. They don't spread. And actually, at some point, the forces become too high and the swarm actually breaks. We didn't really explore that regime too much. We wanted to understand how the bees respond to horizontal perturbation and vertical perturbation so differently and why they do so. And to answer that question, we turned into a mathematical mechanical model of the swarm as an elastic material, where we're basically gonna take snapshots of the swarm at different aspect ratios as it spreads out or it goes back to equilibrium. And the reason we do this is because the time scale in which we apply the perturbation is much smaller in comparison to the time scale that it takes the bees to spread out. So we are talking about seconds for the perturbation, 1 hertz and so on, versus 15 minutes to half an hour where it takes the swarm to spread out. Okay, and so I'm gonna move to the model, but I realized I forgot to say that if anybody has any questions, I'm really happy to take them. You know, now you don't have to wait until the end. So just please let me know. Okay, so the model was a fairly simple representation of a bee. It's just a sphere, kind of what physicists do. So the spheres are now going to be connected by elastic springs to other individual bees. And we arrange them like this in a cone-like structure, but while keeping the top layer fixed. And the first thing we did was to look at the normal mode analysis of these structures. For those of you who are maybe not familiar with that method, All we're doing is writing down the force equations based on the spring potential and assume small deformations of the bonds. And then we have a very large set of coupled force equations, F equals ma, that we put into a matrix form, and then we solve it numerically. By solving it numerically, we can get the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of these metrics, and we can tell what would be the most typical modes of motion that would be expected for that structure. And we see that these modes are a pendular mode, where everything shakes right and left, and also a spring mode, where everything stretches up and down. We can also look at the frequency of those modes. The lower the frequency, the easiest it is to actually invoke those modes, and the more likely they are to occur. So this is what is being shown here on the right side. So we have, on the y-axis, we have the frequency as a function of the aspect ratio, and we see two important things. The first one is, as the swarm becomes more elongated, it becomes, the frequency decreases, so it's easier to invoke these modes. But also there is always a gap between the spring and the pendular mode. It's always a little bit easier to invoke the pendular mode in comparison to the spring mode. And this is actually something that we can see in the experiments. So here is a slow-mo movie of a horizontal perturbation. And we see that there is a propagating wave of deformation that moves down towards this form. And then at the end, we invoke this pendular mode. And then if we apply the same perturbation, the only difference now is it's that it's up and down instead of right and left. This is how it looks like. So the deformation here is really small in comparison to the horizontal case, but I hope you can see there's a little bit of that stretch mode where everything kind of stretches up and down. So the fact that the bees respond to the horizontal perturbation and don't respond to the vertical one suggests that maybe one of the signals that they are using as a cue is the local deformation of the bonds between nearest neighbor's bees. So to test that, we go back to the model, but now we have a more dynamic version of the model where we still have spheres connected by elastic springs. But now we are solving explicitly the equations of motion as a function of time and looking at the dynamics of that material. We have added a few things here. We have some excluded volume and gravity, and we also added a little bit of friction to make sure that the swarm actually stops shaking as a pendulum after a while, which we also see in the experiments. So we're gonna specifically focus on local stretching of bonds. So for each individual bee, we're going to look at all the connections to neighboring bees and measure how much they stretch as a function of time and take a geometrical average of this. So that's what we're doing, and it's summarizing this really long, scary equation, but really we're just taking the geometrical average of all of the stretchings, and we're going to look at it as a function of time. A couple of sanity checks. Here is a three-dimensional swarm. It's cut along the plane of the slide so that we can see what's happening inside. And the colors correspond to the amount of shear that is experienced on average for all the bonds of an individual. Blue means low deformation and yellow means high. So for horizontal perturbation, we see that there's quite a lot of shear at the closer to the base of the swarm. And then if we apply the same perturbation vertically, like in the experiments, like the normal mode analysis, we see that there is less of that local deformation. We can also take a look at the aspect ratio effect. So here is on the right side, again, the same movie from the previous slide, an elongated swarm compared to a spread out swarm. You can see that there's much less deformation that occurs inside the swarm. So effectively, when the bees move from the elongated configuration to the spread out configuration, They also reduce those local deformations of bones to nearest neighbors. So the last thing that I wanted to show with this kind of simulation is going back to the fact that we get different plateau values for the spreading. So there's more spreading at higher frequencies in comparison to low frequencies. This is a bit of a hand wavy explanation for that. So what we think is going on is that at low frequency, we shake the swarm once, has enough time to relax before the next perturbation. But at high frequency, the swarm doesn't have that privilege, and effectively we're creating more strains, not just at the base, but throughout the swarm. Okay, so we have a really good candidate for a local signal that the bees might be using to stabilize their structure. And now, just as a proof of concept, we decided to plug everything into an agent-based simulations where our spheres can now actually sense those local stretching of bones to their neighbors and decide to do something about it. So let me tell you what we did here. So we basically integrate the local signal, the stretching of bones, over one perturbation. So this is how it would look like: one shake to the right, one shake to the left, and then we're summing up all the deformations that is shown here as a color scale. Same thing for the vertical one. And then just as a proof of concept, I'm gonna decide that there's gonna be some threshold above which these bees or sphere are gonna become active and do something about stabilizing the swarm. Chose it in a way that not a lot of the bees in the vertical case would get activated to be consistent with the experiments. So we have a threshold, we have a signal. Now we just need to tell the bees what to do. One thing that we see in the experiments is that the bees are crawling upwards on the surface. So we could potentially direct them and say, you know, also in this agent-based model, please go upwards when you experience the local signal reaching this threshold. But we were not really sure that bees inside a congested and shaky environment would know where upward is. So we decided to implement that rule based on local information. So knowing where upward is will require a global frame, a point of view or framework. And we decided to implement it just based on the local one. If we take the gradient of that local signal of deformation, which is being shown here with the little black arrows, basically pointing the bees upwards and a little bit to the sides. Okay, so that's basically it. And now we plug everything together, and indeed we see that for a horizontal perturbation, we get the swarm to spread out, and for a vertical perturbation, not so much because of the way we chose these parameters. But the important thing is that we can reproduce the behavior of the bees, I think, with these sets of local rules. So to summarize what I showed you so far, I showed you that honeybees swarms regulate their shape in order to potentially become less susceptible to mechanical perturbations. They're sensitive to directionality, to force, to frequency. What we think is going on is that they modulate the aspect ratio to minimize local deformation between nearest neighbors' bees. I want to point out, you know, it's kind of philosophical, but it's something that is worth thinking about. In a sense, the bees, when they climb upwards, they move from areas that experience lower strains to areas that experience higher amounts of strains. And they do this for the greater good of the entire colony. So in a sense, it's a little bit like mechanical altruism. But to put this, you know, in more back to the ground, and connected to the theme of this talk, I wanna kind of summarize it as in the bees, it seems what the bees is doing is locally sense global fields of mechanical strains that have much longer range than the a size of an individual, and they manage a way to sense them and perturb them in a way that would help them survive mechanical perturbations. So that's it with the shaking story. There are a few more things going on in my lab related to the mechanics that I wanted to point out. One is that we are now trying to understand how the bees form these swarms from the air. This is a back at Harvard, we worked with the bees in a shed. So the bees were actually, the door was open, the bees were able to explore the environment, and then, as some of you probably know, they only stay in this configuration temporarily. They actually make a decision using the waggle dance on where to move and build their more permanent nest. So they did this in our experiments, and they just flew off, which was very nerve-wracking. I personally thought we lost the bees. But then they came back after a couple of minutes. And that's probably because we had the queen in a cage to set up that swarm in the first place. So they just came back and constructed the swarm from the air after a few minutes. So while it was nerve-wracking for the first set of experiments, it was actually a very useful, a convenient way to study how the bees form the structure and track it as a function of time. So here is an example of that, where now we are looking from the side, and the bees flew off, and when I started this movie, they started coming back, creating that structure again. And so it's a little bit hard to see by eye in this fast movie, but the shape that they create right when they start creating the swarm is very different from their steady state, more equilibrium shape. So the shape that they create right in the beginning, it looks like a casp-like shape. It's shown here in red, whereas the equilibrium shape is more like a droplet. So it has a different curvature. And this is work in progress, but we think that a casp-like shape actually has some mechanical stability advantages over the droplet-like shape, which we can show with normal mode analysis. And this is a work in progress that we are now summarizing into a paper. Another project going on relating to the mechanics in my lab is asking the question, what happens inside the swarm? So far what I showed you and what we knew is only what happens at the surface of the swarm, because we cannot really see through it. Now we have an X-ray set up in the lab where we can basically put the swarm inside an X-ray and do a 3D reconstruction. And by doing so, we can take a look at the density inside the swarm. And we see a couple of interesting things. First of all, there are these layers of bees that you can see here in the top figure. So they're also very dense in these areas, which would make sense to do because the bees here at the top, the base of the swarm, they're holding the weight of everybody else. So from a mechanical perspective, again, it makes sense to prioritize and add more bees to those layers. Okay, but this is all still work in progress. Please stay tuned. Hopefully it will come out soon. Okay, so this is all I had about the mechanical stability. I'm gonna move to the ventilation. Does anybody have any questions about the mechanics before I move on to a different topic?
Yes, Orit, if I may. Yeah. I have a question. So if I understood well in your model, you are modeling the single animal as a sphere. And yes. You're modeling the collective in terms of forces between them. Right? Mm-hmm. So if we translate mm-hmm. this into the animal would have proprioceptors sensing the stretch, maybe on the legs. Yes. An alternative possibility would be that the animal is sensing the distance. So that by being sort of pulled apart, there is more distance to the neighbor. Now, that would probably change your entire model. But for the bee, it would be an interesting thing, because the bee that is walking on top of the hive or on top of the swarm can sense the distance, but cannot sense the force. And that would give the sort of meandering bee a possibility to decide where to integrate into the network. So my question is, did you consider thinking about distance between your spheres instead of forces between the spheres, thus giving the possibility of integrating new individuals into your whatever shape you have?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you for pointing it out. I did not consider this before, but just as you were speaking, I was a couple of thoughts that came are that first of all, technically, you know, the distance between bees is linearly proportional to the force. If we're thinking about linear springs, that's not the case with the, you know, the real bees, but at least in the model. Now that we actually know that the density inside the swarm is non-homogeneous, so that means that the distance between bees closer to the base will be shorter in comparison to the distance to bees at the tip. I think this could also explain it. So it would be really interesting to think about this, and it's a little bit tricky to test this directly with the bees, because it's hard to know if they're sensing distance or sensing force. And actually, everything that I showed, you know, it's kind of should probably take it with a grain of salt, because we don't really know what the bees are sensing. This is just a set of local rules that would explain their behavior. I would love to think more about the distance. I think it could also work. Okay, so I'm gonna move to the next set of physical fields, and that's gonna be fields of flow. Again, this is work that I did back at Harvard. Actually, my contribution here was only related to the mathematical model. Jake Peters was running this project and running all the experimental work and analysis. Let me tell you give you a little bit of background. Many social insects, as you all probably know, create and build their nest structures in a way that allows for a passive ventilation, such as termite mounds or these end mounds. But bees, at least, you know, in this part of the world where we work with them, tend to nest inside pre-existing cavities. So they don't have the privilege of designing their nests so that it would allow for passive ventilation. So they live inside these cavities in trees. Here are two examples of this. They can have a wide range of shapes of the entrance. Here are two extreme ones. And they also have some other criteria. But the point is that they really need to do something active in order to ventilate their hive. What it turns out that the bees are doing is position themselves in front of the entrance of the hive. For a commercial beekeeping hive, for those of you, you know, I guess I should assume you're familiar, but okay. If you haven't seen one, it's really just a box, and it has a very, very narrow slit that allows the bees to go in and out of the hive. Sometimes there are other entrances, but this is the main one. So the bees basically position themselves in front of the entrance, and they fan their wings. And by fanning the wings, they're creating airflow in this, as you can see here in this movie that actually was recorded by Jake Peters in another study. And so they move air backwards. And then if one bee does this in front of the entrance, nothing really happens because it's so small in comparison to the size of the nest or the hive. So what happens is that they arrange themselves in groups of fanning bees, and they all fan together, and this way they are able to create a more global airflow that allows them to ventilate the hive. Okay, so there are a couple of challenges when thinking about this aggregation process where fanning bees aggregate together. As you can see here, this is a picture with an example of the entrance of the hive, and we have on the right side of the entrance a higher density of bees that are fanning in comparison to the left side. So we refer to that as an aggregation. The challenges are, there are two challenges that I want to mention here. The first one is fluid friction. So let's assume that we have one set of bees on one side of the entrance. They're all fanning in the same direction, so they're driving air backwards. Because of conservation of mass, we're going to have a compensation of air that comes into the hive from the colder environment. And in this case, we have one main interface between these opposing flows. Of course, we also have the sides. But if we had many different groups of these bees that are fanning, we would have more of these interfaces, and we're going to have more energy loss due to fluid friction. So that's one thing to think about. The other one is, sometimes we refer to it as antagonism. So if we have a group of bees that are fanning on one side of the entrance and they're creating this nice global airflow, if other bees would stand at the other side of the, on the left side in this case, of the entrance, they would sort of fight each other, and they would, so if these bees would try to create opposing flow to the ones that are, that is created by the first group of bees, then again, we're gonna lose some energy due to that. So keeping this in mind, the question that we wanted to ask was, again, what kind of local signal from the environment could the bees be using in order to arrange themselves in groups of fanning bees and avoid all this energy loss from fluid friction and antagonism? Okay, so this is a movie from the first set of experiments that Jake ran. And right now we're looking at, this is an aerial view of that hive. And Jake is basically moving a measurement device that can measure airflow and temperature. Let me just move this a little bit faster. So he's basically putting this in all the positions along the entrance. And this set of experiments was very useful because it showed that the air velocity, the temperature, and the density of fanning bees is all coupled. So this is what you're seeing here. The x-axis is just a position along the entrance of the hive, and then the temperature in red, the density in black, and the velocity in blue, they're all coupled. So wherever we have bees that are fanning, then they're going to drive hotter air from inside the nest. And so the temperature is going to increase, but also the airflow is going to increase because they're doing so via fanning their wings that create airflow. The computation, the mathematical and computational model that we applied here assume that we are working with a one-dimensional entrance. So it's a one-dimensional system. We have three quantities. One is the density of the bees that are fanning. We have the temperature entrance, the entrance temperature, and the air velocity. And we're going to make a couple of assumptions that some of them I already mentioned. So bees drive air coming out of the hive, which we know that they do because we can see that they are positioned towards the entrance, and we know that they're driving air backwards. The second assumption is that bees are more likely to fan at higher temperatures. And this is based on a different set of studies by the group of Mike Breed, actually also here in CU Boulder, that show that there is a threshold temperature above which there's a higher probability that the bees would start fanning. And same thing for stopping to fan. So we're going to use that also in the, as a plugin to the mathematical model. We assume conservation of volume. So for any cube of air that comes out, there's going to have to be a cube of air that is coming in to compensate for that. And the last thing is, which I also already mentioned, is that velocity gradients create friction. Okay, so this is all in words. Now let me put this in a mathematical form. So we're going to have a couple of equations. The first one is an equation that connects the density of bees that are fanning to the on and off rate of the fanning behavior that is based on the position and the temperature along the entrance. The second one is Newton's law of cooling. So we're basically connecting the temperature inside and outside at the entrance using this physical law. And we're going to use that to determine the new temperature at each time step. And then the last one is an equation that couples the air velocity to the friction from opposing flows, which we simplify as just a diffusive force that acts on the velocity here, highlighted in red. And we also include the conservation of volume here. So these are all the equations, and now we're basically going to solve them numerically. So here is an example of such a numerical solution as a function of time. Let me just orient you here. The y-axis is the position along the entrance of the hive, and the x-axis is the time, so how many iterations we have in the numerical solution of the set of equations. And the color corresponds to the density of bees that are fanning. So we can see that the left side of that plot, early in the simulation, we have a somewhat random distribution of bees that are fanning along the entrance. And then we have these two bigger clusters that emerge. And at some point, one of these clusters dissolves and is sort of absorbed by the bigger cluster. So we get one big cluster of bees that are fanning, and they create this global airflow in and out of the hive. As a sanity check, we can also look at the cost of friction, which is shown here in blue as a function of time. So we can see that when we reduce the number of when we start to get these larger and larger clusters, then also the cost of friction reduces. And that is coupled with an increase in the what we refer to here as the order parameter, which is basically telling us how large the clusters that we get. So when the order parameter is larger, we have a higher tendency to have larger clusters of fanning bees. When it's zero, then we have this more random distribution. So both of these are coupled. Okay, so now we can actually use that model to create some predictions for longer time scale, how the dynamics of that cluster would behave as a function of time. And here are three examples of these simulations. So on the left, I'm showing an example of the temperature and position of the cluster which happens at lower temperatures. So we get a cluster that is kind of fluctuating and moving around a lot along the position at the entrance. At higher temperatures, ambient temperatures, we get a cluster that is still moving, but it has a higher tendency to kind of stick to one side of the entrance. And then at really high temperatures, which is shown here on the right, it's getting challenging or difficult to distinguish between the temperature inside and outside of the hive, so we just don't get any clusters at all. Okay, so then Jake went back to the experiments to test his predictions. And he designed this really cool chip where it was covered by glass, so we can actually leave it at the entrance of the hive for longer periods of time. And it was automatically logging in the temperature data along the entrance. So each one of these droplets here are a temperature measurement device that measures the temperatures, and it was positioned slightly above the bees in a way that it wouldn't interfere with their fanning behavior. So this is an example of how this looks like. So this allowed Jake to obtain some longer measurements of that behavior. So here is an example of that for 3 consecutive days. The top plot here is showing the ambient temperature as a function of time. So we are showing it for 3 consecutive days. You can see the 3 day-night cycles here in the temperature data. At the bottom plot is shown the temperature along the entrance, which is we know is also a proxy for the position of the bees that are fanning. The interesting thing is that we can actually reproduce these 2 regimes that were predicted by the model, where at higher temperatures we have a cluster of fanning bees that kind of stick to one side of the entrance, and then at lower ambient temperatures we have a cluster that diffuses more. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the fanning. Again, to put this in the context of sensing physical fields, I think here we can sort of think about this problem as a local sensing of temperature gradients or temperature measurements. And by doing so, the bees can impose the airflow that create global channels of air that is coming in and out of the hive. Also here, there's some extensions that I'm currently working on in my lab that I just wanted to mention very, very briefly. There's another behavior that honeybees perform, which is relying on fanning, but it's also at the same time advecting pheromones. So honeybees have the nasal gland, which is shown here at the left figure. It looks like a very, very thin white line. They kind of stick their abdomen upwards and open up that pheromone gland, and then add airflow that is created by them fanning their wings. So essentially they are dispersing those pheromones in a very specific direction. So it depends on their body axis. So this is work that was done, is led by Dumai, who is a PhD student in my lab, but also in collaboration with Greg Stephans and Kesha, who is a postdoc now. She's a faculty in Germany. We wanted to understand how the bees use those signals in order to stay coherent and aggregate around the queen. So, let me stop this for a second. So, here is an example for a behavioral assay that we are running. So we are confining the bees into a semi-two-dimensional arena, and we're looking at it from the top here. We dumped a group of bees here on one corner, and then in the other corner we have the queen that the bees have to find and aggregate around. Actually, the contribution from Greg and Kesha was to help us come up with a machine learning code to automatically detect those scenting events. So that was really important for that project. So we can see, you know, all these arrows that you see here are the direction in which these pheromones are spread. If I just move this a little bit quicker, at the end we see that the bees aggregate around the queen. We see that if we take all of these connection directions of scenting and sum them up together, integrate together, we see that indeed the bees are pointing the rest of the bees towards the queen, which is shown here as this surface. We also connect this to an agent-based simulation where we can have agents that advect that signal. And when we put them together in a simulation arena, then we can also follow that aggregation stage. And interestingly, the directionality of that signal is really important and helps the bees potentially overcome local equilibrium configuration where they aggregate into smaller clusters. So if you want to know more about this, this draft is currently on the bioarchive. I see that I think I'm kind of running out of time, but I just have one more slide that I wanted to show here on a slight, you know, very different, project. But I wanted to just mention this here because I think many of you here in the group are thinking about synchronization. So I just wanted to mention that I'm also working on firefly communication and how they synchronize their patterns. So fireflies have the bioluminescence lantern in their abdomen, and they use that to create a mating dialogue between males and females. There are some species who synchronize their flashes. It's a beautiful phenomenon. I really recommend everybody to see it at least once in their lifetime. In the last couple of years, me and Rafael, who is a postdoc in my lab, and Julie, who is a student, went to the Great Smoky Mountains in Tennessee in the US. And we had a setup where we can actually reconstruct the three-dimensional spatiotemporal pattern of the flashes. We just published the methods paper about this, but there's a lot in the work related to what kind of mathematical models could explain this behavior and so on. So if you invite me again, I'll be happy to talk about this, or otherwise just stay tuned. Let me just put this acknowledgement slide where we just want to thank everybody who I work with, and also my new lab that is shown here. This is Halloween, pre-COVID Halloween, and all the funding of my funding sources, and thank you all so much for your attention, and happy to take any questions now.
Michael Smith works on
honeybee.
Hey, Orit, how's it going?
Hello, good, how are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I great talk. It was really nice to watch. I was actually, so one of the questions I had about the nest ventilation system, and that is, I think it's a really cool system that you're able to model it in a two-dimensional way when you have a Langstroth colony, but the size of those entrances is so radically different than what you would see in a natural nest. And so, obviously you have to like make certain conditions, but I was wondering what you might think would occur when you have a more naturalistic entrance that, you know, it's like a knot hole, and that the bees actually have to deal with all this different variation in the size of their entrance.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And we don't really have any data on this, besides some anecdotal information from the literature. So there is a species of honeybees, and I'm blanking out on the name, but I think they're not living in the US. When they have a very small entrance, they don't have the ability to position a lot of bees at the entrance, even if they wanted to. So what's happening is that they move into a different strategy where they all fan at the same time for a couple of seconds, and then they all stop fanning for a couple of seconds. And if you think about this, it's kind of like breathing. So they create air. It's not two channels of airflow. There's only one. And they alternate the flow in and out intermittently. So that's probably all I can say about what happens in feral real hives, or you know, with honeybees. But if I remember correctly, you have a lot of experience working with feral colonies, and if you want to think about that problem, I'll be happy to talk more.
Yeah, no, I think honestly, like, this is probably something for us to just to email back and forth about. But one of the things, and this is very rare to see, is that you'll sometimes actually see honeybees, even Apis mellifera, they will actually use propolis to further decrease their entrance size. So you can imagine your normal entrance, and they'll actually will even build propolis up. They're always building these walls, and they actually, I mean, the size of their entrance can be so minuscule that it's like, as a beekeeper, you think, oh God, these bees are gonna suffocate themselves. So really, I'd be really interested in kind of, I mean, because in these, it's very rare to see them actually build these like kind of reducer entrances, but even those, they actually have multiple entrances. So it's almost like this alignment that you're seeing, you might actually even get a more extreme version in these natural nests. But yeah, it'd be really cool to look at in a natural system. But yeah, I really enjoyed the talk. So thanks for talking.
All right. Thank you so much.
On that point of nest of entrance constriction, I also did work with honeybees a lifetime ago, and my advisor at the time would always tell me that it was a defense against the constriction of the entrance was a defense against a hive beetle. And so it, I mean, whether or not that's true, it's an interesting sort of discussion where here everything is being thought about and discussed in the context of a single optimization problem. But of course, in a natural system, it's never a single optimization problem. And so I do wonder how these things interact. That actually wasn't my question, though.
Okay.
My question was actually, maybe there's no answer to this or it's not yet known, but I found it very interesting, the figure you put up about the response to rain and mm-hmm. the polarization of individuals in the rain. The first thing that springs to mind, of course, is, well, could it be otherwise? What kind of bee would be able, even under heavy load of water, to take a position that was any different to that? And then the second question that sort of leads from that is this sort of response to a medium like water, a liquid medium, an exaggeration of how they would respond to airflow, or is it sort of a difference in degree, or is it a difference in kind? And could you think of some clever experiments where you manipulated the density of the medium that they were in to really probe some of these questions you have about channeling and flow?
Okay. So you're saying it's all fluid dynamics, whether it's air or water, right? And then,
well,
so
you could ask that question, I guess, by forcing fluid dynamics on the system.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I think there's definitely ways to manipulate the the regime of flow you would expect. But I think it would be a bit challenging to do with bees. Like, you cannot really put them inside viscous materials to simulate low Reynolds number and stuff like this.
But if you increase the flow of air over a group to be very, very strong, would they take up this exact orientation as they do in rain, do you think?
That's a really interesting thing that wouldn't be too out there to try with a fan or something like this, just to see, you know, what happens. That's an interesting idea. By the way, as far as I know, I'm also not sure that people really understand the advantage of creating those that ordering of the bees in response to rain. It, you know, resembles roof shingles. So there is a, I think that I definitely have the intuition that it helps with wetting, but I don't think it has been systematically studied. So even studying it with just water, I think, would be very interesting.
Yeah. I wonder, is Michael, maybe you know, is it Apis dorsata that has these huge ones that have these open, that does this defensive rippling in response to predators? That would be one, a species that has these open combs that I imagine would frequently get rained on, which might be an easier system to look at it.
Yes, it is Apis dorsata that does that. And actually, the positioning that you get those bees with the tip of their abdomen kind of pointed out is very similar to what the dorsata waves to prevent other individuals from landing on. Alex, I don't know if this is an inappropriate question to ask, but can I share an image with Orit, or just to send it to her?
Yes, please. I think the answer is yes.
Well, because the reason I was actually, so when you, I was like, oh, I should show that propolized entrance. And as I was looking through my photos, which understandably is all bee photos, I have no photos of friends, just bees. I actually found a stingless bee nest that actually I think would maybe get to that kind of three-dimensional question. And it looks like they could almost even have like an inflow and an outflow in this single tube. I can maybe, I can email it to you, but basically just imagine a tube and they're all arranged in a circle. So you could think of an inflow and an outflow in the same way. But this is for stingless bees. I don't know how much fanning they do, but it's just, I don't know, just cool stuff to send around.
Was that in the US?
This particular image that I'm looking at is from Panama.
Okay. Yeah, cool. I would love to see it.
Hey man, field seasons. It's the reason we do biology.
Yes.